I have various thoughts and feelings coursing through me. I haven't taken a time to try to construct them into a formal talk. So I have as much idea as you what I'm about to say. First thing that I want to mention is that I have recently discovered some very sad music. And isn't it interesting, you know, how I love sad music. I don't know about all of you, but you know, it's not my favorite. You know, classical music is my favorite kind of music. I listen to all kinds, but classical is my favorite. And sad classical music is my favorite kind of classical music. And you know, and Elton John had a song, Sad Songs Say So Much. And what is it about sad music, you know? And there's this phrase, you can't play the blues till you pay your dues. You heard that phrase? Mm-hmm. Can't play the blues till you pay your dues. And initially when I heard that saying, I thought it meant, well, you can't play the blues unless you've suffered. Now that I've, when I was a younger man, that's what I thought. Now that I've lived longer, it's well, big wow, everybody suffers, but not everybody's a blues musician. So that can't quite be right. You know, everyone has their bucket load of suffering. So that phrase would have no meaning if that's what it meant. Everybody would be able to play blues. But actually, I think paying your dues is learning how to compost your suffering, learning how to transmute your suffering into meaning. You know, suffering is inevitable. What we do with that, that's the first noble truth. That there is suffering. There will be suffering. We will lose the ones that we love. We will be stuck in the elevator with the people we don't care much for. I'm paraphrasing Buddha's actual words. he didn't mention an elevator, but when he starts to talk about the types of suffering, you know, losing the ones that you love and having to deal with the people that you don't care much for is a couple of the examples, you know. And so under the best of circumstances, we suffer. And then sometimes circumstances aren't so great and we suffer tragically. What do we do with that? How do we live on that? I think it's very, very important. And I think the beauty of sad music has something to do with the fact that suffering is inevitable, but suffering calls for resolution. So on some level, in some way, we need to work with our pain. We need to work with our suffering. And as I said the word resolution, I thought of music again. Because good music is not all consonants. It's not all fifths and thirds and pleasant sonorities. Good music has dissonance. It has chords that have, you know, strange notes in them that, you know, eventually resolve into harmony. And that's the power of music. It's, and there's the acoustical phenomenon, you know. In the acoustics of music, there are consonants and dissonance, you know. An octave, a fifth, a major third is a perfect consonant. It's in solid resolution, solid ground. You know, major chord, you know, like, and Beethoven would hammer that major chord over and over and over again. Yeah, I'm done, yeah, I'm done, yeah, I'm done. But then there's an imperfect consonant of a minor third. And a minor chord has this kind of sad-ish, compared to a major chord, has a sad-ish kind of flavor to it. And And the vibrations of those pitches have mathematical ratios. So a perfect fifth is, I didn't know I was going to talk about acoustics. I think it's like maybe 2 to 3, you know. An octave is, you know, 1 to 2, you know, it's double the vibrations. A fifth, you know, so there's, you know, and the less consonant the interval, the more complicated the fraction, interestingly enough. And so that's analogous to, you know, the complexities, the pain of our life, you know, needs to come to some kind of resolution. On the dashboard of my car, I have 3 pictures. 3 of them, interesting. I just hadn't thought about the third. But 2 of them are of my son Jacob. And I was looking at them this morning. And one of them, he's a fairly recent picture. He's, you know, a young teenage boy. And the other picture, which is starting to fade, I looked at it, it says, I need to get that out of the sun and into a photo book because it's starting to fade. And and I don't have a duplicate of it. And looking at that picture of him as a young boy, I felt regret. I felt regret for all the times that I was emotionally unavailable to him, all the times where I was too busy to respond to him. Particularly when I was going through divorce and the confusion and pain around that. In the moment, looking at his picture this morning, I felt regret for myself as well as for him, you know, that, you know, how much I might have missed. But if you talk to people who know me and my son, who, you know, have known me and him all through our lives together, they will probably tell you that I'm an excellent dad. I think, you know, objectively, I think I'm doing pretty well, like, because, you know, he's a very healthy person. And I would proffer that if it is true that I am a good father, and Jacob adores his father, that regret has a lot to do with it. The feeling of that regret has formed me as a father. I know that. When I knew that Eva and I were separating, and we got divorced before we got separated, we got divorced. We were living in Green Gulch together. We discovered that we were no longer in love with each other. And we continued to live in Green Gulch for maybe 3-4 years together in the same house, co-parenting. Somewhere during that time, we went through the paperwork of getting divorced and then continued to live in Green Gulch together in the same house. And then came time to leave Green Gulch and consequently to physically separate. So we got divorced and then later we physically separated. There was pain and confusion and anxiety during the divorce time. But that was different from the pain and confusion and anxiety of the physical separation. When I knew it was coming, I did some research. I actually went to the library and thank goodness for computers, so I could actually, you know, search for stuff in the library on the computer, and found this book. And I'm not sure of the title. I don't know the author's name anymore. But it was something like Live Away Dads. And this person was a psychiatrist or a psychologist who also was a father who had divorced. And so he did research about the phenomenon of, you know, what happens when to the dads and to the relationship of the dad with the children when there's a separation and divorce. And oftentimes, relatively quickly, in a variety of frequencies, I guess, a lot of times the father no longer makes effort to stay in touch with the children. And this author said that most people assume that, well, the father doesn't care. But he said that his research indicated, I didn't, when I drove here this morning, I didn't know I was going to be talking about this. And I'm just feeling some emotionality about it now. It's surprising me. When he did his research, what he discovered was, what's going on is each time when the father has to leave the children, he's re-traumatized all over again. He goes through that pain of separation all over again, and it just hurts too much. Yeah. And to avoid that pain, to avoid that suffering, he just can't handle it. He loves too much, and it hurts too much. And so he shuts his heart down because of the enormity of the pain. And that makes a lot of sense to me. First, you know, I moved to Salinas. Jacob and Eva moved up to Sebastopol, and that first, and I'm seeing him maybe every other weekend when things were going well. When I mean going well, scheduling wise, you know, when we could actually get our logistics together well, I was seeing him every other weekend. And that first month or so, I would stop at Safeway or some other store and get a bottle of wine. Go home and drink it, make myself to sleep. And then it kind of dawned on me that this would be a problem if I let it happen for any prolonged period of time. So I stopped that, and then I started going to Mount Madonna every Sunday for kirtan. I would be getting up at like 3:30 in the morning, so I'd get up to Mount Madonna before dawn to bliss out with the kirtan. And I was doing it compulsively. I was on the run from my pain, and I was using the heart bliss of kirtan to try to escape my pain. And then when I had Krishna Das CDs in my car going constantly, and then a light bulb appeared over my head, invisibly. And I realized that I was addicted to kirtan, or I was developing a kirtan addiction. I was medicating myself with kirtan. And then I found the voice of Krishna Das very annoying. I couldn't listen to that stuff anymore. And then, you know, I was reflecting on this maybe a year and a half or so after this period of time, and I had a lot of tender feeling towards that man that was struggling to figure out how to cope with his pain and doing various things to cope with his pain. Oh, I forgot to mention that, you know, as I was speaking a moment ago, I thought about Suzuki Roshi when he talks about a good father is not necessarily a good father. A person who thinks he isn't a good father but is trying very hard to be a good father. When he's talking about the four horses and that the worst horse is actually the best horse. The person who has a lot of pain in his house and a lot of difficulty sitting actually will probably understand the nerves and more readily than the person who can sit comfortably. So our problems actually become the fodder for our practice. So how we relate to our pain is so very important. You know, being a Dharma teacher is a hard sell because trying to sell the Dharma as a Dharma teacher can be a hard sell because coming to terms with, turning towards that which we really want to flee from is a big part of it. But it's very, very important this is learned, that it's understood. We were, Dan, Mary and I were cleaning the space in preparation for our sitting today, and something occurred, and I told Mary I was probably going to include it in my talk, because it, I didn't tell him why, because it seemed to fit in with some of the thoughts that had been germinating within me. And what happened was, I was sleeping, and in my hurting hip awkwardness, I knocked Jesus off the wall. And I said, oh my God, what have I done? And I looked at him, and he's in the Garden of Gethsemane too. And Larry said, well, that's good then. He's suffering in the garden, so this is just some more suffering. Oh, so you're telling me that by knocking him off the wall, I'm doing the Lord's work? And then I said something like, that kind of rationalization is why we're in such a mess in this world. And when I said that, when it came out of my mouth, it made me think of something that I was talking about with a Dharma friend just yesterday. And some of the things that I said to her. Some time ago, I had heard that in Burma, or Myanmar now, that it has been a very Buddhist country. And someone told me that they don't allow fly swatters. In most workplaces, there's a lot of flies, but they don't want you to use a fly swatter to deal with the flies. However, they have no issue with fly paper. And the rationale behind this is when you take the fly swatter and you see the fly and you strike it, you're generating a karmic impulse. You're generating a mind of killing. That has karmic consequences. When you're sticking up the fly paper, you're not killing anything. The fly kills themselves accidentally. The fly kills the fly. And this is in classical primitive, I would like to say, if I don't get in trouble for saying it, in primitive understanding of karma, this is understood. The negative karma is generated from the impulse to kill. And the notion is, when you're actually got an impulse to kill, you're generating the karma that affects your mind state. Slapping fly paper on the wall is a deluded impulse to kill.
Not deluded, but diluted.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say. Diluted. Thank you for the clarification, because that is my point. It's a diluted. I think there's still karma there. And I think the fact that it's diluted is a problem, not a benefit. I think and this is very important. It may not have as strong of an effect on any particular individual, this sort of conscious awareness effect, but on the social level, it has big consequences, I feel. And as my mind was dwelling on these thoughts, I remembered a book that I read. The title of the book is Why We Kill. And the author, his name I forget, but he's a military officer, psychologist, colonel, I think, in the Marine Corps, perhaps. And he talks about how when warfare was like face to face, when you used when you had to look at the person you're about to kill, it was more difficult. And in the battlefield, there was a lot of people wouldn't flee the battlefield, but they wouldn't kill. The number of intentional killings versus the number of shooting and intentionally missing in like World War I, World War II, was striking. As we got more sophisticated as we get when we're like when we're up in an airplane and we've got a radar screen, a computer screen, and we're dropping a smart bomb on a target. That, you know, the munitions dump or something, and we don't see the person we're about to kill. It becomes easier to kill. And as it becomes easier to kill, we kill more and more and more people. So I think there's some, you know, there's something deluded about the notion that it's less karmically consequential to use flypaper than to feel the pain and the karmic consequence of killing. It's good to feel the karmic consequences of killing if you're going to kill. So, you know, if you're going to kill, you know, do it viscerally so that, you know, it's healthier, you know, psychologically, socially anyway, not it may drive you insane. So, very important how we suffer. The suffering that I eventually learned to digest in my anxiety over what would happen to my son, what would happen to my relationship with my son, and the pain, and feeling the pain fully, and finding a way to continue to feel the pain fully, even this morning. I felt the pain of regret, of having missed things, of having made mistakes. And wanting to hang on to that faded picture. Keeping that pain alive, not to fabricate or not to wallow in it, but legitimate pain, keeping it in awareness when appropriate, keeps us on the path. And objectively, I'm probably a decent father, and I have the joy of having a young teenage boy who adores his father. That's somewhat exceptional. we have a very solid relationship. And that's another thing that this author, the psychologist who is the Live Away Dad, said, is that the Live Away Dads who are concerned about the relationship and are determined to do whatever possible to keep a relationship with their children, some kind of relationship, even if it's less than ideal, ironically often end up having a much more significant relationship than perfectly married dads. There's a depth to it. There's a commitment there. There's, you know, the time together is cherished. And so, this, the suffering of the Live Away Dad bears the fruit of a depth of relationship that would not have been there minus the suffering. So this is an example how important it is. Find the tenacity not to turn away from our suffering and our pain. It's going to be there. And if we try to deny it, if we try to run from it, it chews us up and undermines our well-being. If we carefully, gently, compassionately, clearly turn towards it, walk with it, it keeps us on the path. So, sad music. What is it about sad music that actually consoles? It takes the dynamic of our suffering, transforms it into beauty. And it's still painful, you know, but it's beautiful. that showed how the suffering, interpersonal suffering, our own suffering, when held carefully, also can enrich our appreciation of the beauty of being human life. That's not all there is to life. You know, sometimes when people hear the first noble truth of there is suffering, they hear it as life is suffering. Sometimes the Buddha is misquoted as saying life is suffering. Like, you know, it's all a bummer. It's all a bad trip. You know, find the escape route, get off the wheel, enter nirvana because samsara is just no good. That was an earlier paradigm. But that's not what the Buddha actually said. He said there is suffering. You know, dukkha happens. Shit happens. Other things happen too. And so it's not just suffering. But there is suffering and it is ineluctable. It is inevitable. But the ones we love will die. The ones we wish to avoid might actually move into a cubicle next to ours next week. We can't control, you know, life is beyond our control. Now, I also wanted to say something about Zazen, shifting gears, but that's kind of related in a certain way. I'm always struck about how radically plain Zazen is. Our practice is so very plain. It's just what's arising in the moment. It's just the sound of the birds outside, the squeaking distant voices outside right now. There's no drama there. It's just an aching hip, or the sound of children's voices outside. What's interesting to me is when we are, and a little caveat, anything that anybody says about Zazen is bound to be off the point. So I'm bound to say things that are actually wrong, but there's something I'm trying to say anyway. Because I'm about to say that when you're in the zone of Zazen, which implies that there's a zone of Zazen and there's a not zone of Zazen, and on some level it's problematic, on the ultimate level it's problematic, but nonetheless, when you're in the zone of Zazen, when there's just the sound of the birds, when the voices of the children come in with a quiet, empty mind, sometimes it's so peaceful, sometimes it's so spacious, and there's this feeling of peace and gratitude, and I had a moment like that at this point. But it's so plain. It's just the voices, it's just the sound of the vehicle driving by, it's just the children or the seagull. You know, it's not some phantasmagorical, psychedelic, orgasmic thing. It's very, very plain. But when you're there, resting there, it's so wonderful at the same time. The thing of it is, it's rather uninteresting to the ego. Now, I use the word ego, and sometimes it has a pejorative ring to it, like bad, moral failing. It just means a sense of self, self-preoccupation. Some teachers call it the self-addiction, where we're more interested in our own personal dramas, we're more interested in our narratives, which is not, and that, putting it that way, can sound pejorative once again. We might be more interested in working on a very wonderful novel, or ideas about the next painting that we're going to make. and that can be a thing of great beauty. But it's preoccupation with our subjectivity to create something wonderful. So it's not necessarily bad, this self-preoccupation, this ego. It's not a bad thing. But the zone of Zazen is uninteresting to that. There's no drama there. There's no arc of a storyline that is intriguing. It's very boring to the ego. And if we're suffering, if we have this narrative of pain oppressing our subjectivity, we may not feel worthy of the zone of suffering. We may feel it's inaccessible because of the state of our heart and mind. So it's a very, very interesting thing. But Dogen says, you know, once you've adjusted your posture, rocked your body right and left, and settled into a steady, immovable sitting position, think not thinking, he says. Yeah, what's that mean? Think not thinking. What is not thinking? Non-thinking. This is the essential part of Zazen. What that means is make an effort to stretch into that part of your conscious awareness that is not thought. Stretch into that part of your conscious awareness that is beyond thinking. You don't have to declare war on thinking. You don't have to declare war on the ego. But just think not thinking. Think of that which is not part of the drama, not part of the narrative, not part of the self-preoccupation. That is you too. And there's peace there. There's no suffering there. The suffering is still going on, but there's no suffering there, and that's accessible. It's paradoxical in language, because the suffering continues, but there's no suffering, and it's always accessible. We may not be interested in it, we may not feel worthy of it, but it's there. And touching base with that now and again can give us the resiliency and the spaciousness to work skillfully with our suffering. So even though it's kind of boring, please give it a try. It'll be helpful to you. Okay? And I think I'm done. Whatever, we can have some conversation now if you like. And then sit for a while. Get up and stretch our legs and sit for a while.
I'm going to say something right away because my husband died June 22nd. And it's so interesting because it's been 2.5 weeks of intense kind of care, but then maybe a year, maybe 2 years, I haven't gotten back to my suffering. Is the suffering kind of helped me to not really be suffering very much at the moment because I don't have to take the wheelchair down to the 4th of July and try to lift him up and all these things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm trying in a way to get back to tears that will come mm-hmm. when I think of my life before those 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to that, which will be grieving.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right now, Elizabeth, if I was understanding you correctly, there's some sense of
relief.
Yeah, I was you read my mind.
But he's 93
relief for
prayerful
him as well,
and
yeah.
died fast and
yeah.
peacefully, all those things. And then one other thing I just had to say is I've been surrounded by my children, and then I see that they are affected by it too. So
yeah.
They are looking at their suffering in different ways, and that's kind of work now for me at the moment because.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're looking forward to grieving with longing.
Oh dear, do I?
No.
I'm looking forward to just Arnie coming back and to live with me, but not the one that was around for a year or so. I'm already beginning to just have him come to live with me. So, and I guess that so many thoughts came up. So it was wonderful, and I do have a son who's a father with children that aren't there, a wonderful, wonderful father, and I wish he'd come today. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
I guess I'm a little guilty of fly paper, fly swatter situation. With the snails and the garden. And I, you know, like everybody I know crushes them, and you're so beautiful, you can cut them and crush them. So I take them and I just roll them out into the street. Just as far as coming. And I have a professional gardener, right? One of my clients caught me doing that. And she was really upset with me. She said, you know, they can call back. I said, or they can get run over. And she just kind of looked at me and said, well, I crushed them. And I just kind of felt like, well, I wanted to say, well, okay, I will, but I knew that I wouldn't.
Yeah.
And it's just the snails in particular. I mean, I do have a professional problem with that. My clients want me to kill them.
Well, killing, you know, I'm not a vegetarian, and I don't kill my own chicken. But I try to remember that I'm not killing my own chicken. I'm not killing my own chicken.
That's hard to do, killing your own chickens. I think I became a vegetarian for a couple of years after I couldn't lower the axe.
Yeah.
I think I could kill a chicken because I'm going to eat it, but the snail, I'm just killing it because
he's
going to eat
the flour.
Yeah. When you said crush it, then you said flush. And then I thought, oh, she means flush them out so that they can eat. You know, because people sell them. You could sell them.
There's a pertinent thing in the Sandokai Lectures of Suzuki Roshi. It's during question and answer. Mel Weitzman, you know, former Adams Death Center, who's going to be a Tassajara in a little while, and I hope to see him. My hip is making me wonder if I can go to Tassajara. During question and answer, he says that, well, there's a spider crawling on the mukugyo, you know, the thing that we strike with a hammer. And he said, you know, and I saw it there, and I tried to hit someplace else, but he went right into it, and I ended up, you know, killing him. And, you know, Suzuki Roshi said, well, you tried, your intent wasn't to kill, but you killed anyway. And maybe the spider's better off. He actually said something like that. And then he said, that he mentioned, I think, in that lecture or someplace else, that, you know, in the garden, we kill very, very many earwigs. And sometimes, you know, we're concerned about that, and we talk about that. And if we could find a way to garden without killing earwigs, that would be a good thing. But we can't stop our life in the meantime. And so we're going to continue to garden and kill the earwigs. And then he said, not to kill is a dead precept. I'm sorry is a living precept. You know, we can't live without killing. You know, life lives on life. And to try to think that we're going to be righteous and moral and not kill is delusion. And that points right back to, you know, how we suffer, you know, is what matters. You know. And the Native Americans honored the buffalo that they depended upon. They worshipped, you know, one might say, the buffalo. And that was their way of, you know, dealing with it.
My 12-year-old goes to school in Mexico, and they, one day they had to bring chickens or whoever had them to kill them last year. And so I dropped her off, and there were these kids with little boxes or looking in. And, and then later that day,
I was touched by your talk. I have a lot in common with your story, so with the son and the divorce and ongoing, he's particularly challenged, and it's a very, to be involved with that is a very deepening experience. And what your talk reminded me of, I used to study with Joseph Bulgro. He's a Zen teacher in San Francisco, and also a psychotherapist. He's used to, I remember the words, in order to understand something, you must stand it. And he kept repeating that throughout the course. So kind of where I'm at now, my own, what I'm working on, you know, and you kind of made that inference in what you were saying, is kind of summed up in the word truth, and noticing that my relationship to what has really happened, to what is true, is a struggle. But at least it's on the radar. And it's kind of a vector that I try to point at least noticing how I have all, you know, the kind of resistance that you were talking about in relation to it. And certainly it's a bigger context than suffering per se. As you said, there's a lot more to the unfolding experience than just suffering. There's a lot of joy and appreciation, creativity, and wonder. Appreciated and was touched by your
share. I remember when I was about to move to Salinas, and I hadn't moved to Salinas yet. I don't know why I thought of the story about Jacob, but I just did. We visited Salinas. I work in a soup kitchen. I'm a mission director for an agency, a nonprofit that works with the homeless in Salinas. And so he and I went to visit the soup kitchen, and we go inside. While we're there, John Beasley, a homeless volunteer, offers him a yogurt. And so David takes the yogurt. And then we hang out for a while, and then it's time to go back to the car and leave. And then Jacob says to me, "Daddy, when we get to the car, can I talk to you about something kind of serious?" And I say, "Well, sure, of course." And in my mind, I'm saying, "Oh, shit." He's really freaked out by this environment. He's afraid he will never want to come back again. That's what's up. And I was pretty sure that he was going to, that, you know, he was troubled by the soup kitchen. So we get in the car, and he says, "Well, okay, what did you want to talk about, son?" He says, "Well, you know, Daddy, that guy in the soup kitchen, he gave me this yogurt. And I didn't want to hurt his feelings, but I don't like yogurt." And then, you know, I'm gushing with pride, and I say, "Oh, son, that was very kind of you. That was very, you know, very sensitive, you know." And he says, "Well, then, will you eat it?" And that's Jacob to a T. You know, he's very, very considerate and thoughtful, and he's got a sense of humor that won't quit. He's a character, you know. And when you mentioned the joy, you know, I thought of that story. You know, that, you know, I'm the father of a, I think, unbiased that I am, a pretty amazing 13-year-old boy. Got a solid relationship with him, so all the and dealing constructively with the pain has something to do with that, I think. But I'm being repetitive here. Okay, if there's nothing urgently waiting to explode from your lips.
I want to know what the third picture is in your car.
Oh, Suzuki Roshi. The no drama spaciousness that can contain anything. Okay, on page 4, top of the page, after lecture.